Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore. We're glad you are tuned in. We continue today with Connie Ellis's reading of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly, a novel about a handful of people in a northern Minnesota town. We pick up now where Connie left off last time.
Chapter 2 continues. Bernie ambled ahead toward the lake. The path was arched with whitish trees. The whole forest was lightening up now. It had the feel of woodland clarifying and shaking down for winter. Bernie heard his man following dutifully. When they got to the shoreline, the water lay ice-colored and wide, still unfrozen. I guess if he shot something in the water, it'd be gone by now, though, Darrell said. You still in a hurry, Darrell? I was wondering about this afternoon, is all. Don't wonder, Bernie said now, looking all around. This afternoon, you're going to see Steinsider and get him in compliance. Nervousness transformed Darrell's mouth. It flopped open like a lasso. Steinsider is just about the toughest fourth-generation German-American in the country, Bernie went on with satisfaction. His eyes kept moving along the shoreline, here and there, then along a line about a yard inland, too. He is tough, but tough doesn't mean armed, just means ugly. So just tell him about having that flag draped out all over County 10. See if you can get it through his head that he can't interfere with a county road right away. He will tell you how tough he is. Let him. When he's all through talking, you tell him to get in compliance. Bernie stooped over. Here we are, he said. He picked up a baby black bear in his arms. It was stiffening, curled up. It might have been about 40-45 inches long, and except for the wild red-rimmed eyes, looked like a toy bear. Bernie pressed the paw pads. It already had 3-inch-long claws. See, he already had a lot of what he needed in life besides his mother and some luck. Good claws for climbing. Good for scratching anyone who gives him a bad time. Bernie kept looking through the little animal's fur. The bullet had struck him in the right hip, but passed on through. He ran out of luck, all right, Darrell said in an indifferent tone. Yeah, he did, Bernie said. Look at this, Darrell. See how the leaves are all scratched up here? Wasn't a good shot, so the cub died slowly and clawed around because it hurt. You carry the Kona bear and the rifle. When they got back to the police car, Bernie put the cub in the back seat, half sat, half curled over like a baby, was fed and is now falling asleep. Its stunned dark head rested on its own baby shoulder. Bernie moved the rear view mirror to see it, and then shoved it back up into the right angle for rear vision. I don't guess it will take too long to take care of Steinsider, Darrell said in a thin, conversational tone. Bernie gave a laugh. There's two ways it can go. You can tell him what you want him to do in 1 minute, and then he tells you what you can do with yourself for 8 minutes. And you leave telling him what he has to do for another 1 minute. That's a total of 10 minutes. Or the other way it can go is you tell him what you want him to do for 1 minute. He tells you what you can do with yourself for 8 minutes. You tell him what he has to do for another minute. You leave and he joins you all the time you're walking back out to your car to tell you some more about what you can do with yourself. He'll probably work me into it, too. Yep, I wouldn't be surprised. He will tell you that you can tell me for him what I can do with myself, too. Heck, Darrell says, I don't guess he'll actually hit me, though. He hits you, I put him in the slammer for 72, while I figure out something else I feel like doing. They had drawn up alongside the station. Neither man got out. Bernie said, cheer up. Either way, it's over in 15 minutes. Here we are on a Friday afternoon, and you get done with Steinsider. You can go home. For the whole weekend? Darrell said. He brightened. Sure, Bernie said. Provided Steinsider doesn't draw on you, of course. "Draw on me," cried Darrell. Then he calmed himself and added compassionately, "Oh, God, but he will be sorry if he draws on me." Then he added, "Just joking. I'd love to bring that guy in for assault with a deadly weapon, though." Bernie said, "Speaking of assault with a deadly weapon, did you skip shoot practice again last week, the week before? When was the last time you practiced? I thought they sent you 2 warnings. "Oh, those people," Darrell remarked. "They got nothing to do except send warnings." Okay, that went into Darrell's record, too. "Well, yeah," Darrell said with a smile. "I mean, if I ever get through work." "All you got left is to talk to Steinsider," Bernie said. "Take some advice from me, all right? Don't be afraid of Steinsider. Just tell him if he doesn't get that drag line moved off over the highway, we get him on a 160-27. You get to say anything else you want to, just as long as you tell him the law. You can tell him you love the flag yourself. Tell him that flag of his hangs better than any of the other crap arrangement people have rigged up since 9/11. Flags on their bra top, bathing suits. Tell him his flag is so good because it is so big, it moves around, opening and turning the way it does in the wind. Nicer than the little flags that other people have. You can tell him I said that if you want to. Or you can tell him you said it. I don't care either way. Tell him people can talk USA this and USA that, all right? But the funny thing is, different people have told you whenever they've driven along on County 10 and seen his gigantic flag for the first time, they feel like crying. Grown men," Darrell said. "But Bernie, no one has told me anything like that. You want I should lie to him or what? And you always on me about lying, too." Both policemen saw the school principal slanting his car into one of the 15-minute only places that Bernie and Darrell kept for people renewing licenses. "Just tell him grown men cry when they see his flag. Just tell him. Then tell him he's got to move that drag line and get the flag out of the highway clearance." Bernie said, "I have to go in and see whatever kid Donald's come in about." Darrell glanced over into the principal's car. He said, "I used to hate that guy when I was in school. He'd knock kids' heads against the walls down in the basement where no one could hear." "Quit stalling, Darrell. Go out and see Steinsider." Chapter 3. The auto dealer found himself clinging to these last days' limbo before he was supposed to start chemotherapy in Duluth. Stan Garris was shrouded in a single obsession, a privacy that reminded him of the privacy he had enjoyed with his lab, Silver, before someone stole her. The two of them had gone about the slow paths alone with just one thought in their heads at any one moment. When Silver smelled partridge, then partridge was all she pointed out. She did it with her eyes, tail, wriggle of her body. And Stan, once told, changed his shotgun grip a little and thought only of partridge. Now that Silver was gone and he had cancer, he went around scattershot inside himself, glancing 4 or 5 times a day at his upcoming death, many versions of it swelling in his mind's eye, vanishing, then another one appearing like a new clip further on in the same movie. Only 2 weeks ago, he had gone to a GM dealer's enrichment session. Its centerpiece was sales knacks for auto lot stock when a major design change was scheduled for the next quarter, like every dealer update conference Stan had been to in the last 20 years. This one had soft fill inserted in the last after-lunch session. It suited everybody. You sleep through it, and you haven't missed anything. Yet the manufacturer comes on as attractive for having hired a woman trainer to do psychological stuff. 2 weeks ago, the focus was on how to get senior support staff to do multitasking better and how to hire new staff who could distinguish between multitasking and just plain inattention. Stan and George, his salesmen, had shaken their heads. In a small-town dealership like Garris Autos, all you asked for was office and service department help to do just any one thing without making a mess of it. Yesterday made the eighth day Stan knew he had cancer. Doc Anderson had not said he was a dying man. He said the new chemo options were 100% better than even 2 years ago. But Stan had studied the physician's face and decided that what he read in it was this: this patient is dying, but needs to feel hope because hope helps medicine work. One way he knew he was dying was that he usually saw Doc in one of the St. Fursey Clinic's patient examination rooms. This time, the reception nurse guided him much further down the short hall. They went past an open bathroom door with a mirror facing the hall. Stan saw what in his right mind he knew to be himself passing, following a nurse. The fellow whose face he regarded morbidly was in his early 50s, with large eyes and a reasonable expression. But the skin was so colorless and the eyes so passive. As if looking back, Stan was shocked. The nurse and he also passed the technical room where two women in white bent over microscopes. Stan recognized the near one as the piece of work who recently had suggested that he f*** off just because he had offered to show her the wonderful oddie on his lot. Not an etching, just an oddie. That oddie being supposed to appeal to up-and-coming professional young women. He decided to cut her if she looked up, and when he went past, cut her, he explained to himself, no business person in her right mind cuts anyone. You see an angel who clearly gets around on wings. You still might sell him a car someday. Still, Stan told himself lightly, you're dying. You have to go on taking a little off people here and there, because that's life, and you are still in it. But you don't have to take it from everyone anymore. The reception nurse took him to an office he had never seen before. It had proper chairs like someone's living room, chairs with colored upholstery, no exam table, and on one wall, real books. None of the usual feel-good posters of senior citizens taking vitamins, always senior citizens and couples, smiling aggressively. What about if the man of the couple was dying of cancer? They never showed you that. He noted Doc Anderson's medical books. At least they looked very much like Stan and Kenneth Part's books, kept handy on shelves in his own office, as well as in the service department. Private items lay on Doc Anderson's desk. Clearly an unopened envelope from the Cullough High School. That figured. Doc had his older kid in high school. A grocery sales flyer from Marty Hank's supermarket, which everyone around had gotten this past week. So old Marty Hank's was going to try to keep up with Denham's Bakery and offer replacement meals. Largest of all, a manila envelope from Stanford Garris, printed by hand in the upper right-hand corner. Doc Anderson said, take this with you to St. Mary's in Duluth next week. But I have also sent them everything from the computer. And Stan, ask them questions. But don't get upset if you forget the answers. Just ask again. One of the things cancer patients do is forget a lot of what they're told. Doc Anderson gave a friendly, sheepish kind of smile. They just do it. In fact, some people take another person along, a relative, to take notes even. They bring notepads, clipboards. Stan said, do you mean do that or just women? I don't know. I should think so. Stan said, in your practice, though, Doc, do you know any men who take someone along to take notes? I don't, as a matter of fact, the physician said. Stan reached for the envelope now. He had been going to a minute ago, but his fingers had kept moving around at the same time as they felt numb. The moment passed. He felt stable. He slapped the package of x-rays between his side and his elbow. He put together a grin and looked over. I see you're practicing up for tomorrow. A piece of sheet music now showed that must have lain under Stan's x-rays. The doctor seemed to relax. "I don't get this one part, Stan," he said. "The altos keep getting ahead of its tenors. And it shouldn't be like that. It should be that they start the bar first." He moved the sheet over to where Stan could study it close up. "But by the end of the third bar, we should be together." Stan didn't read music worth 2 cents. Stan looked at the words, though, to see if he could figure it out. "From all transgressions, set us free. Who would thy chartered freedmen be?" No one knew what any of that meant, of course. Stan had been brought up in a Lutheran church, more or less, but even his mother had gotten bored with it and quit. He caught her letting herself into the library with her own key one Sunday afternoon in order to go on the web. Stan himself went to services, what few he went to keep Ginny off his back and to be able to look old Pastor Nymet in the eye. Even really simple people like Menzies, the school principal, were bored with church. Menzies, that poor sap, had to show up there because the Board of Education members and a lot of other people knew that he slapped bad kids around. But if he showed up in church, it confused people's judgments. People would decide he wasn't all bad. Stan had to show up in church because everyone knows auto dealers will, sooner or later, just naturally shave you close as a snake, but maybe they wouldn't, too, because at least, look, there was Stan Garris, along with the other usher, lined up at the back pew with the 2 collection plates, waiting for the organ to slam out. "All things come of thee, O Lord, and of thine own have we given thee." So Stan, for years, went smartly up the aisle with Donald Menzies. As for this annual Thanksgiving ecumenical choir, he sang in it to be together with friends during the snack breaks, but mostly because it gave him a community activity with Ginny, without having to listen to any of her conversation. She was a soprano. The soprano sat in front of the basses, so Stan, a tenor, got to be over on the opposite side behind the altos. "Doc, I can't tell," he said after a moment. He had to stand up and go now, even though his mind felt rested somehow, sitting there in that nice, familiar doctor's presence. He shook hands with Anderson. "Thanks for the direction sheet, too," he said. Dr. Anderson stood up as well. "I'm sorry you got cancer, Stan, but we're on it, and we have an excellent chance to win the fight." But he used that elegant language, "excellent," instead of "real good." Stan wasn't so dumb. They were in the presence of death. That was what gave Doc the formality. Stan could hear that much. His life did a complete U-turn when he left Doc Anderson. His mind prodded him every 3 or 4 minutes. His mind said, "You're a dying man now, Garris." He got back to the lot, geared to recall what everyone's work was for that day. His own, George Herlick's, Kenneth's. His mind kept interrupting. "None of this matters. You," it said, "you are a dying man. Forget the day's schedule." No wonder he tied on one at the VFW the way he did. Now Saturday, he was not only a dying man, he was hung over. Stan ambled casually from his glassed-in office out to where George was showing a car to someone Stan hadn't seen before. The car was one of this year's pieces of inventory trash. Actually a perfectly good vehicle, but both Stan and George got to hating any car that cost him $300 a month just because it's sitting there and the economy was down and people hardly bought Kleenex when they had a cold. It wasn't anywhere near noon, but Stan went over and slouched down onto the sofa in the new car showroom. The sofa was still covered with Silver's blanket. Her light hairs had felted into its worn upholstery. "Oh, Christ, Silver," Stan thought. "I wonder if you are dead or alive." George Herlick was showing a Suburban to a stranger from out of town. Stan stayed put, playing the part of one of their regular deadbeat non-customers looking over new car mags. Deadbeat non-buyers were mostly wistful teenagers It would grow up into car buyers, like Doc Anderson's nice kid, and old retired geezers who kept themselves looking nice in a single-color woven shirt and satin doll sweaters and khaki slacks because they had once perfectly good jobs like anyone else, and Stan wouldn't throw them out. Or they had been veterans in some war that seemed honorable. Old Ward Hines, for instance. Stan had to be careful which people he let hang around in the showing room. Now he himself was too sick-looking to get into any part of a sale. Still, he listened carefully from the couch to the best salesman he'd ever had. Old George didn't miss much. He spent about 2 minutes explaining the flex fuel option to the customer. Then, because the man asked no questions about the E85 stuff, but was bent looking in windows without a twitch, George went to talking about using the new Suburban for family. As in no one needs to be so crowded, they're always sitting on some kid's abandoned Eskimo pie. The man kept looking in the car windows. So George switched fast again. Guns and dogs and a fast getaway he was on now. You got the weekend, but say that's all you got. You don't want to spend all Saturday morning of it wrestling with the car furnishings, especially if you stayed late Friday making sure to wind up everything at the office. Stan shot a quick look up over a full-page ad for V-belts. George was a genius. George had clearly decided, and as Stan did now, that this guy wasn't any executive around any office. He'd never stayed on a Friday night to sort out market decisions for any company or any staff problems. He sold insurance, maybe. He didn't hire or fire anyone. So George had brought out the line about clarifying all office issues with a firm hand before the weekend so you wouldn't have it all waiting for you on Monday. The prospect said, "You said it," flattered. George stayed firmly on the car's RV advantages. "What I like about it," George said, "is kind of a personal thing with it. Me, actually. It's how you can change all the arrangements inside so fast. Some cars, they say you can take a seat out here and put something else there, or you can turn it into a camper, all that kind of stuff. But when you get started actually doing any of that, you're suddenly tied up for an hour of monkey work. Not this one. I like it for hunting because it takes less than 20 minutes to set up for space in the rear, and you don't kill your back doing any of it either. That's just a personal reason, though. I suppose it's because I hunt." That George, Stan thought. If you ever used a rifle except on a skunk, this is the first I ever heard of it. George's man wore camis with the wet woods deer pattern. He now wore the classical half-glazed look. He pussyfooted slowly around the whole car. George didn't follow him. George even backed away a foot or two. That meant George had decided the man was buying. The man trailed one hand with infinite delicacy along the hood design, the side, the back door, and now back to the opposite side, where George waited with a very serious expression on his face. The man was making the car his own. A good 2-3 minutes ago, that car had stopped being some glossy E85-equipped Suburban in a northern Minnesota GMC showroom. It was this out-of-town guy's car now. Stan knew all George's moves from here on out. He fantasized the whole thing. George would take the fellow into his own office. They'd talk payment schedule. Then he would want to introduce him to someone else. This made a buyer feel that he himself had gladdened the whole GMC dealership. The buyer up to then would have thought, wow, a big business for such a little town. But when Stan propped his head in wanting to be introduced, the buyer would get somber and sigh himself, what a good corporation this is. Big and go ahead where you want it, but mom and pop too, so you realize there's nothing like the personal touch and this dealership has it. George and his customer were emerging from George's cubicle. "I'm going over to the police station to get your plates," George was saying. Stan's mind cut in. George would be doing this after Stan was dead, too. His mind continued. Everyone would do business in the usual way, but he would be dead. His mind told him how George would call. On my way over to get your plates, go get your lunch, go to Denham's. That's the bakery, south side along 4th Street. They have deli sandwiches, thick on the meat, crusty bread, none of your thin flap of summer sausage, and no Dijon. Stan's mind said the man would do it, and then George and his wife Mercine would drive the customer's old car up home for him. Mercine was always knitting something, and the new car owner would feel strange with the paper flooring sheets still down. And in the next instant, George began the scenario verbatim. Go to Denham's, etc. The customer fiddled his hands around the car papers and said, Deli sandwich sounds good. It had better not cost an arm and a leg. I just purchased a big car. The first twinge of buyer's remorse. The fellow's a good sport, though, willing to make a joke. George was right on it. There's people eating at Denham's who are never going to get a decent car in their whole lives. Not a chance. The customer looked pleased. He left. George came ambling over to Silver's couch, and Stan stood up, trying not to look sick. High five. Nice going, Stan said. The one great white hunter sells a suburban to another great white hunter. George said, time, too. Now we're down to only one of those bed and breakfast vehicles. Stan said, can you hold the shop the rest of the morning and this afternoon? I can leave Kenneth with everything this morning. I'll go get this guy's plates, and Mercine and I were going to go to Duluth for yarn, but we can make a supper date out of it. Take the man's old car home for him. Not far either. He's from Chisholm. Handy, he added. No word of Silver, I don't suppose. They talked about the stolen Labrador for a moment, and Stan went into his own office. Stan sat down, feeling rotten, and laid out his day. He would sleep, then drive over to Tenebrae Creek Drive and get to his 2 o'clock easily. After that, see Vera Hall, school principal's secretary. If she was at home, he would discuss her pickup with her. Then he would see if he could find Peter Tenebrae and pitch him the idea he had hatched up last night. A pretty good idea, considering he'd been so drunk he'd had to ask Vern Denham to drive him home from the VFW. He had fallen into bed to dream heavily. He had dreamed the idea to run past Peter Tenebrae. Well, hell, actually, he never would have had the idea but for his mother. She was the one rooting around in internet chat rooms like a smart old sow scooting all over the web all the time, hatching up ideas. Before he had become a dying man, he listened when she talked, because she was a very likable person. Now that he was dying, though, he got more sense. He heard the goodness of this last notion of hers. She was a wonderful person. She was likable, all right. He loved her.
You've been listening to Episode 3 of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly. This book will run for 20 episodes through July 23rd. If you miss a day, remember that all the week's episodes are posted on our website, ktwh.org, on the Literally from the North Shore page, on the Programs drop-down menu at the top of the homepage. Be sure to tune in again for the next episode of Shelter Half.